Patient and stand with me as we sing to his glory. Be seated. First, I want to congratulate you on being here today again for a lecture. You're improving, and I'm proud of you. Of course, I realize our lecturer is not the ordinary lecturer, but nevertheless, I'm proud of you for being here, and thank you for being here today. And it is my joy to welcome back today to our campus once again Dr. D.A. Carson from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois. Now, I know you can read all the fine things about him in the program, and so I'll let you do that, but I want to ask you a question this morning. How many of you presently subscribe to a periodical? You get a learned journal of some kind of periodical. Now, be honest, how many of you get one? At least one. All right, I'm proud of you, and I'm ashamed of the rest of you. Now, in addition to 1,500 books in your personal library upon graduation, you will also be questioned as you cross the platform as to whether you receive at least 5 academic journals that you are taking on a regular basis. Here's one called BibSac, Bibliotheca Sacra, which is published by Dallas Theological Seminary. And I hold this one up particularly today because if you noticed in your program, our lecturer is the editor and author of more than 40 books, a considerable contribution for a man who is only 53 years of age. But that doesn't even begin to tell the story, because I open up my copy of BibSac here, and the very first article, the lead article, is God's Love and God's Wrath. How do you reconcile the two? Written by D.A. Carson. It's actually the fourth in a series of 4 articles on the love of God. Now, if you have not read that particular article, you need to read that. You're going to be asked that question out there on the mission field, in the pastorate, wherever you serve. How on earth can you believe that God is a God of wrath and still say that he's a God of love? And not only does Dr. Carson answer that question in that article, which is worth the price of an investment for 10 years in BibSac just to get that one article, but in addition to that, he deals with the whole problem of the sovereignty of God and the freedom of man in one of the most fair and gentle ways I've ever seen. And so you need to go read that article. Now, why am I telling you all of this? Well, of course, first of all, I want you to subscribe to some journals. And second, I want you to read that article. But third, and most important, by way of introduction today, I want to say that it is very seldom that God raises up a scholar who has to be respected, no matter where he goes in the world, by people who even don't believe a single thing that we as evangelicals believe. It is even more rare for that particular scholar to be a person who is of such a gentle and pastoral heart that he understands the questions that lie most tenderly around the hearts of individuals and speaks to them in a way that we can understand and comprehend. We ought to be grateful every day for D.A. Carson, for his wife Joy, and for his son and daughter, and we ought to pray that God will bless them in a very special way. Dr. Carson, it is an infinite joy to have you here at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. We're glad to have you here yesterday. We're glad to have you here today. And when you decide you want to be a part of this faculty, we'll be glad to have you here permanently. Would you welcome D.A. Carson?
I don't know who the bigger sinner is here. Mr. President, President for saying all these nice things, or me for enjoying them. It's very remarkable on your part that you should invite somebody outside the orb of the SBC to say something about evangelism. It shows a remarkable catholicity of spirit, I think, to put up with someone like me. And then not in my discipline either. I'm supposed to be teaching New Testament, and here I'm rabbiting on about postmodernism. So in addition to all of your other many virtues, your extraordinary patience with an outsider and someone talking outside his own field is all very commendable, I'm sure. I would like to direct your attention this morning to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, and I'm going to begin by reading verses 16 to the end. And while you're finding it in the Bible, let me remind you of what we did yesterday. We began with the rising biblical illiteracy that characterizes the Western world. We tried not to be too generalizing. There are all kinds of pockets, not least in the South, where there is a residue of a fair bit of biblical heritage. There are all kinds of people, moreover, who still live within a modern epistemology. We tried to define those terms yesterday, and who are impressed by evidences and that sort of thing. But that's not where the drift of the culture is going. And in many parts of the country, you can find the majority of people, certainly the overwhelming majority of educated people who have no biblical knowledge whatsoever, who do not know the Bible has two testaments, who know nothing of the storyline, and they do not present to us a blank slate on which to write, but many have absorbed rather a different set of assumptions. And in the religious field, it often emerges as some form of New Age thought. Epistemologically, they are postmodern, and they have bought into a set of packages that make it difficult for them to acknowledge the possibility of objective, transcendent truth. Before I read this passage, I do want to say this. I do not want ever to give the impression that postmodernists are all wrong. It's very difficult to be wrong about everything. There's some people who try, but it's very difficult to be wrong about everything. Postmodernism has some very strong advantages, too, and some things that evangelicals may learn from. After all, modernism itself was not always a great friend of evangelicals. Modernism was characterized by extraordinary arrogance, hubris, about how autonomous reason can discover eternal truth. And there is a sense in which postmodernism has been a great help to criticize this arrogance and to expose the futility of finite beings coming to necessary and absolute truths. But postmodernism itself becomes arrogant when it starts insisting that its discovery of relevance is itself an absolute truth. And so there is a sense in which thoughtful Christians really do not want to be called either modernists or postmodernists. There are some things to learn from both. If I had time, I would outline a form of epistemology that is not too dependent on either, and is far more dependent on Scripture. But that would be another set of lectures in another field where I'm not supposed to know anything, so I'd probably better turn to the Bible. Acts chapter 17, verses 16 and following. While Paul was waiting for them, that is for Silas and Timothy mentioned in the preceding verses, while he was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance. But now he commands all people everywhere to repent, and he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead." When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered. But others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. So reads God's most holy word. First, the realities Paul faced. This man Paul is really quite wonderful and not easily intimidated. In the ancient world, Athens still had the reputation for being the premier intellectual center, followed closely by Alexandria in Egypt, and Tarsus, Paul's hometown. It's a bit like arriving in Cambridge, Mass, or Oxford or Cambridge. You first get there and look around at these buildings, some of them centuries old. The Parthenon was there. We go and see the Parthenon in Athens today, or what's left of it, and we admire those Corinthian columns, and we admire the frescoes and so forth. That's not what Paul did. Paul assessed everything out of a biblical matrix. He was neither intimidated by nor frightened of what he saw in Athens. From God's perspective, he was simply dismayed at the degree of idolatry. He was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Where you have highly educated people, you have highly educated sinners. And for all that I think we ought to love God with our heart and soul and mind and strength, we should no more insist on the superiority of mind above all things than on the superiority of emotion above all things. We must insist on the superiority of God above all things. The pluralism that Paul faced in Athens was not simply the pluralism of polytheism, though it was that. There were many gods, many competing religions, many competing philosophies. But it was also part of imperial policy. It was a deeply enmeshed structure in the culture. You'll recall from your Old Testament history that when the Assyrians took over a new area, and then later the Chaldeans, the Neo-Babylonians, took over a new area, they had the habit of transporting the leaders and the primary economic powers and the leading citizens and so forth. The reason, of course, is because it tended to quell rebellions in advance. There was a kind of threefold tie that needed to be broken if rebellions were to be minimized: their gods, their land, and their self-identity as people, their religion, their land, and their self-identity as people. Well, what the Chaldeans did and the Assyrians did was to transport the people away from the land. And because the gods were connected with the land and with the people, you've broken this threefold tie, and the possibility of rebellion is a lot less. So they moved the Jews out, and they moved other people into what came to be called Samaria. The trouble is, of course, in the long haul, if you do that empire-wide, it's economic stupidity on a gross scale. It means that you're destroying your tax base. These people move off to some other place, and they have to start all over again at the bottom of the economic ladder. So by the time the Persian Empire arrived, that policy was reversed. And in the providence of God, that was the framework in which God fulfilled his promise to restore Jews back to the promised land. In fact, the Persians did this as a matter of imperial policy. By the time you get to the Roman Empire in the New Testament, the problem still exists. What do you do? But they had learned from history, and they no longer did this sort of thing. What they did instead was arrange for god swaps. Instead of moving the people, they moved the gods, as it were. Most gods in the ancient world were connected with a particular tribe, or a particular land, a particular heritage. They had certain domains. When the Romans took over, they insisted that the local people accept some of the Roman gods. And the Romans themselves took on some of the local gods into their pantheon. Then, in the case of civil war, whose side were the gods on? Got a bit confusing. Dampened the military spirit a wee bit. And it didn't destroy the fiscal base. Move gods with a lot less economic damage than moving economic leaders. And thus, you see, the empire had a vested interest in massive cultural, religious pluralism. Once Paul and other Christians move outside the security of the synagogue, that's what they're facing everywhere. You can believe anything you like and argue for it as strong as you like in any corner. What you must not say is that there's only one way. Moreover, he is now dealing with people who are characterized by utter biblical illiteracy. Now, Paul starts in the synagogue, we're told that in the text, but he also argues in the marketplace, and these people know nothing. They have never heard of Moses. They don't know about the Hebrew canon. Except for those that are attending synagogue who may be God-fearers or even proselytes, the vast majority of people don't know anything about this sort of framework at all. They've never held what we call a Bible or any part of it in their hands. They don't know the storyline. Not only so, but they are committed to different worldviews. Paul carefully names a couple of them. In the NIV, we're told that they are philosophers. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. For us, philosophy means something like this. It's a minor discipline taught in well-endowed universities of an obscure and abstract nature that has very little relevance to the rest of human life. But that's not what philosophy meant in the first century. Philosophy was something close to what we mean by worldview. And roving teachers taught then well-constructed philosophies, worldviews, trying to compete in the marketplace of ideas to get people on board to think their way. Thus, one of these views, for example, held that the gods are made up of atoms so fine that they live in the spaces between the other worlds and between the other atoms, and they are thus unmoved by what takes place in the hurly-burly of regular life. And thus, a proper approach to life is to be removed from the hurly-burly of life, to be distant from it. Whereas Paul talks about a God who's actively engaged in creation and in sovereign providence and active redemption. The other group was convinced that the way ahead was to leave the passions to one side and to follow eternal logos, reason. And thus, passion should be viewed with suspicion, and the good of life is to live in a reasoned, ordered way in line with nature. And thus, you find your fulfillment in this kind of discipline. But the God of the Bible is not removed. The God of the Bible is as passionate as he is sovereign. Thus, these are competing worldviews, and only two are mentioned of many that are well known to us from the literature of the ancient world. Moreover, here there was condescending hostility. It's not as if Paul was viewed as an intellectual peer. He was viewed as a scrappy man, a seed picker, the kind of little bird that goes along, picks up a bit here and a bit there and a bit somewhere else. No, there's no system, there's no rationality, there's no coherence, there's no thought. These stupid right-wing fundamentalist bigots, they pick up little scraps and they preach it as if they understand something. Don't they understand Michel Foucault? Haven't they absorbed Derrida? Ignorant twit. Well, that's the way Paul is pictured here. And then there's even a little bit of cultural and racial phobia, too. He seems to be advocating foreign gods. You can just hear the sneer coming out from their voice boxes. These are the realities Paul faces, not entirely different from what some of us face today. Now, let me not try to draw parallels that are too close. None of their epistemology was postmodern. But on the other hand, there are a lot of parallels, and we should be aware that when the gospel moved out of the safety of the synagogue, that was par for the course. So much of our evangelism until about 25 years ago, and still in some pockets of relative conservatism today, it is still the case, our evangelism has been amongst churchy folk who already have some kind of biblical, theological, Judeo-Christian framework. That's not the way the gospel advanced in the first century. We're merely returning to the first century. There is a sense in which you can read your Bible today with a lot more impelling sense of relevance and power than 30 years ago. Now, for all the wrong reasons, mind you. It's not because we've made great advances. It's because we've slipped back into new faces of paganism. But on the other hand, this is not a time for chicken-heartedness. It's a time also to see that the gospel has faced this sort of thing before. Number two, the priorities Paul adopts. First, the realities Paul faces, and then second, the priorities Paul adopts. First of all, of course, he adopts the primary policy of preaching the gospel to those with a shared heritage. And in this case, they're the Jews in the synagogue, and the proselytes there, and the God-fearers there, verse 17. And this, of course, for him is not merely a point of convenience, though it is certainly that. For him, it is also a salvation historical primacy. That is, God disclosed himself through the Mosaic covenant to the Jews first, and Paul sees that the gospel is to the Jews first, and also Roth is to the Jews first. Not because they're better or worse, but because in many ways they are exemplary of all of us. And then, having committed himself to that task of preaching in the synagogues, he also displays an immediate urgency to preach to those with an alien heritage. He preaches as well in the marketplace day by day with those who happen to be there. It's very important to see that the Areopagus address didn't sort of drop out of the sky as an offering. He was actively involved in street evangelism, as it were, before this opportunity came in the higher courts of the land. Now, it's at this point that I need to make a small aside. There are some circles that argue that Paul made a big mistake in this chapter. Their reasoning is like this. When you get to the end of the chapter, the NIV says that only a few believed. And unfortunately, Paul doesn't really get to the gospel, does he? He talks about abstract thought and philosophies and worldviews. Why doesn't he just preach Jesus? In fact, when he goes on to the next town, Corinth, by that time he had learned his lesson. And so we find him writing to the Corinthians a little later and reflecting on what he had learned. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, he says, "I resolved among you to preach nothing save Jesus Christ and him crucified." So what you learn from Acts 17 is, don't do it this way. Now, that view is quite common in some conservative circles. Let me tell you unambiguously that it is a load of unadulterated bilge water. Let me give you 8 or 9 reasons why. I'll go fast. I'll speak with my southern drawl. I will go fast. Number one, this is not the natural reading of Acts. That synthesis is adopted by coming to Acts and then flipping to 1 Corinthians 2 and then reading 1 Corinthians 2 as if it's a response to what takes place in Acts. But when you just read through Acts, there's no flag that Luke sends up and says, now at this point, we suddenly change pattern. Up to now, we've been talking about what Paul does right, bless his heart. Now this is what Paul does wrong. There is no flag in Acts that tells you that. Number two, Acts 17, as we shall see in a moment, is entirely in line with Paul's own theological commitments. Virtually every line of the Areopagus address, you can find Paul expounding elsewhere. This is not something that's different. It is merely recouched for the pagan mind, as we'll see. Number three, Paul does not say at the end of chapter 17 that only a few believed, despite the NIV. He says that tenes de believed, certain people, and then others, heteroi, sneered, and so forth. In other words, the particular expression that he uses is not denigratory or restrictive. It's an expression that Paul uses elsewhere of the breakdown of numbers when the gospel is preached. In any case, you don't have more than a few score people at an Areopagus address, perhaps 100 or two. You really can't expect another Pentecost with 3,000 converted when you've only got 100 people in the first place. I believe in miracles, but that one would really be a whopper. Number four, transparently, Paul was cut off. In other words, he didn't finish what he was saying. He got to the resurrection, and at that point, there was enough sneering that he had to quit. But in the fifth place, if you want to know what he would have said in the pagan environment, we're already told in verse 18. That is, he was sharing the good news. He was evangelizing. That is already a technical expression by this time in the book of Acts. It means he's preaching the gospel, Jesus and him crucified on the cross. Moreover, number six, at this point, Paul was not a rookie. It's not as if he had just graduated from some third-rate seminary someplace and was scared of his own shadow and was off in some church and was terrified by everybody and so was trying a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of something else. This is a man who's been in the ministry for 20 years and has been beaten up regularly for his pains and has evangelized in pagan context before. Look at the Lycaonia situation, for example. He's thought things through. He's not a rookie. He was immediately intimidated. In fact, the immediate context is not that he's intimidated by Athens, but that he's appalled at the paganism. And then, in the seventh place, 1 Corinthians does not cast Paul's resolution to preach the cross against the background of Athens. 1 Corinthians 2 does not say, when I was in Athens, a few kilometers back up the road, I goofed. But when I got to you, then I resolved to preach Jesus Christ and him crucified. That's not the context. The context in 1 Corinthians 2 is this. When I got to Corinth, I discovered how much you people were really impressed by eloquence and form and presentation and style. You're much less impressed by content. And for me, I resolved when I was among you to preach Jesus Christ and him crucified. The eloquence was another matter entirely. That's the context. So it is not only this view misinterpreting Acts 17, it is misinterpreting 1 Corinthians 2. In any case, number 8, in 2 Corinthians 10, written after 1 Corinthians 2, in 2 Corinthians 10, Paul still sees it as important to bring every thought into obedience to Christ. And in that context, it does not mean that every thought must be pure and clean in a kind of privatized, individualistic way. That's true, but it's not Paul's point. Paul's point is that he wants to bring every worldview under the lordship of Christ for testing, cleansing, transformation, so that he goes out there and he is out to capture every worldview going. And he's still resolved to think that way in 2 Corinthians 10, because that's what he's done all along. And lastly, verse 34 is very important. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. We have sometimes taken that to mean a few people got converted on the spot. I don't think that's what it meant. I think it means, rather, that Paul had got this far in his address, and while some sneered, some were so taken by what he said that even though they hadn't heard the gospel yet, and they hadn't really got this whole thing articulated, they became disciples of Paul. And because they became disciples of Paul, in due course they heard more, they were taught more, and they believed. That's the way university missions are today. 25 years ago when I started doing university missions, the overwhelming majority, as I indicated yesterday, had some knowledge of the Judeo-Christian heritage, and when people got converted, they tended to get converted during the mission. Nowadays, the vast majority of people converted in connection with university evangelism get converted later. I did a small day one at Oxford not very long ago, and there were 16 people that signed up for ongoing investigative evangelistic Bible studies that we set up. These were bone-ignorant biblical illiterates. But they had been sufficiently captured by the Word that, as it were, they became followers of Don and then believed. In those days, you didn't sign up at a university. You signed up to follow some teacher. And these people had been caught up enough with what Paul said that they became disciples of Paul. And thus they learned a lot more, and they believed. Which also tells us that sometimes what we must do is build the structures that make Jesus coherent when you're dealing with complete biblical illiterates. Now in the third place then, the framework Paul establishes. Here I wish I could spend a couple of hours, instead I'll spend about 10 minutes. When Paul first approaches them, he says with a certain amount of respect, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." I think the word we would use today is very spiritual. Religious still is a word today that has negative overtones outside of conservative circles. But spiritual is an in word today. Doesn't mean much, but it's an in word. It doesn't mean what Paul means particularly. It can mean almost anything, but at least it's a step up on being a philosophically committed naturalist. At least you're interested in something beyond space and time and money and chance. And that's what Paul says. I see that you're very spiritual. Without particularly commending their understanding of spirituality. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, he doesn't even call them gods. He's very careful in his language. I even found an altar with this inscription to an unknown god. Now, most gods in the ancient world had certain domains. Sometimes they were tribal domains, but there were other domains as well. If you wanted to take a sea voyage, for example, you offered a sacrifice to Neptune, the god of the sea. You wanted to give an address, then you offered a sacrifice to Mercury or Hermes in the Greek world, the god of communication. You wanted to go to war, you had Zeus on your side. And so it was very important in every domain of life to get the right gods locked into the right situation so you could get the right blessing. Trouble is, there were so many gods and so many domains that you might miss some and really get into hot water. Probably somebody had constructed this particular idol to cover all the bases. It hasn't been shown up yet by archaeology, but it might show up someday. What Paul understands, however, is that this sort of approach to religion betrays a massive ignorance of the divine in principle. Your massive ignorance I will now expose. What you ignorantly worship, I will declare to you. Can you imagine? He started courteously, he started gently, he started in categories that will not put them off, but now he is insisting that what he's going to declare is going to blow their minds. And he begins. Now you can read the rest of the Areopagus address in about a minute and a half, if you're a slow reader. There is no way that the Areopagus addresses first given took place in a minute and a half. These addresses could go on for 2 or 3 hours. So what you have here, undoubtedly, is merely the outline. Every one of these points would have been teased out at some length. And in most cases, you can find out how Paul would have teased it out because the subject itself is treated somewhere else by the Apostle Paul. Let me go through some of these points with you to show you what he does. The God who made the world and everything in it. What do you have here? First of all, you have a vision of God different from paganism. Paganism's pantheism. Paganism had many forms. But where paganism had a pantheistic form, the world and God sort of elided into one. The ancient Greeks could speak of gods in the plural and God in the singular, and they could slip back and forth between the two because underlying their particular forms of pluralism was often a kind of assumed pantheism. But here there is a vision of God who is different from the world. He is the God of creation. Before the world was, God was. And he made the whole thing in heaven and on earth, an absolute universality. That's the picture that he paints. Not only is he transcendent then, above the world, and the creator of the universe, he is the Lord of heaven and earth. That is to say, he is not simply the Lord of the sea, or the Lord of the Jews, or the Lord of the Greeks, or the Lord of the Stoics, or the Lord of the Baptists. He is the universal sovereign over all. In other words, he is painting monotheism and its entailments. And he does not live in temples built by hands. Now, Paul is not trying to relegate the temple of the Old Testament to irrelevance. Paul would be the first to insist that God manifested himself in the tabernacle and in the temple. But Solomon, at the dedication of the temple, was the first to recognize that at the end of the day, you don't reduce God to the dimensions of a temple. The whole world is like a footstool to him. Isaiah insists that the nations are nothing but the fine dust of the balance. But there's more to it than that. The point is that in an awful lot of pagan religion, you sort of got your way with the gods and weaseled blessings out of them by offering the right sacrifices, by going through the right rites, by working through the appropriate systems. And thus, in a sense, you've got a domesticated god. This domesticated god will pour out the right blessing upon you so long as you get the sacrifices right. The god sort of has to, provided you get it right. It's a kind of tit-for-tat religion. But Paul says this sovereign, transcendent, creator, providential God is not a domesticated God. He's not trapped by religion, forced to give things, provided you get your religion right. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. You see, so many of these gods were portrayed as so human, more or less souped-up humans, that they got really frustrated and angry if you didn't stroke them right. One of the reasons why you placated them with sacrifices is so they didn't get mad at you and do something nasty and mean. These gods needed to be stroked. And you know, there is a rising tendency in evangelicalism to think of God that way. Dear old God needs our worship, poor chap, or else he's really unhappy. We bring him great pleasure by getting our worship right, don't we? He needs us. And he's terribly frustrated, wringing his hands painfully. Oh, if only they would turn to me. Poor, frustrated God. But in the first instance, we must recognize that however much God commands us and invites us and entreats us, he doesn't need us. He just doesn't need us. He was perfectly happy before the universe was formed. He didn't form the universe because he was miserable and lonely. Before the universe was, the Father loved the Son. That's what John's Gospel says. The Son loved the Father. He wasn't lonely. He doesn't need us. You start dealing with a God who doesn't need you, and you can't butter him up to twist something out of him. You can't domesticate him. You're stuck with grace, or you got nothing. The Puritans had a word for it that we've largely lost. Aseity, A-S-E-I-T-Y. He's described constantly in the Puritan writings as the God of aseity. It's a bit like self-existence, only more so. When we speak of self-existence today, we're usually talking in the domain of origins. I'm not self-existent. I am made by my parents. And in the final analysis, I'm made by God. I have a dependent existence. But God has self-existence. That is, no one made him. He always was. He is of himself. Aseity goes one step farther and says he is so much of himself that he doesn't need us. The Old Testament writers could catch it in nice little phrases. If I wanted a McDonald's hamburger, God says, in effect, would I speak to you? The cattle on a thousand hills are mine. I can kill my own beef, thank you. He doesn't need us. He doesn't need us for anything. In fact, it's the reverse that is true, Paul says. And thus he's beginning to switch over increasingly into anthropology. He is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men and life and breath and everything else. Every breath you breathe is by his sanction. And if he says stop breathing, you're dead, and it's his sanction. Every bit of food you eat, every bit of clothing you wear, every bit of human company, every shelter, he is the God whom James describes as good and changeless, not like shifting shadows. And every good and perfect gift comes from him. The dependency is all the other way. Now he's overtly in the domain of anthropology. From one man he made every nation of men. Many of the pagans had different creation myths or origin myths, and some thought that certain groups came from some gods and other groups came from other gods and so forth. Paul won't have it. There is one human race, not a trace of racism here. We only have one parent, only one, and we all come from that one parent. In fact, one of the entailments of monotheism is mission. For if there is but one God and one humanity, then recognized or not, that is the only God for that humanity. Thus, one of the entailments of monotheism is mission. Moreover, he's not the kind of tribal God that is interested only in one group. You see, he may enter into a covenant relationship with Israel, he may enter into a covenant relationship with a church, but that doesn't mean that elsewhere he washes his hands and is no longer sovereign. Rather, from one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. He's sovereign over the whole shebang. Doesn't the Old Testament say that? He may be the God of the Jews, but he's also the God that holds Babylon to account. He's the God that holds Nineveh to account. He's the God who holds all the nations to account. And it always remains true that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. But God arranged things so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out. Now, for the first time, you get a hint that things are maybe not as they should be. For the first time, you are being introduced to notions of fallenness and sin. They don't know God. That hasn't been introduced yet, but now it's introduced. And it will be unpacked in great detail in a moment. Moreover, Paul has so stressed God's transcendence over against the pantheism and the paganism of the day that he realizes the danger of slipping into what would later be called deism. God's so removed that he's not intimately involved with us. So now he stresses the immanence of God. He wants human beings to reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. You can hear Paul quoting the psalmist in his mind. How shall I flee from your presence? If I go to the dawn of the morning, you're there. If I descend to the bowels of hell, you're there. Now he introduces sin. Doesn't call it that. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. He's going after idolatry. You know what Paul would do here? In his mind, he's expounding Isaiah. In his mind, he's doing in a pagan context what he does in Romans 1. The hardest thing to get across in a university setting, I indicated yesterday nowadays, in evangelism, or any postmodern pagan setting today, is getting across the notion of sin. But let me insist in the strongest possible terms. If you remember nothing else in these 2 days, you remember this. You cannot agree on the solution until you agree on the problem. You can't do it. If you believe that what is fundamentally wrong with human beings, as many Greeks did, not all, but many, is that we're stuck in a material body when what we really need to be is to be spiritual and free, then what you want is a religion that frees you from your material world. If you believe that what you really need is some kind of new age appreciation of the transcendence, then what you need is some set of crystals or something to give you the right vibrations. But if you believe that what is fundamentally wrong is that God's image bearers have rebelled against him and he is bitterly offended, his majesty insulted, his holiness angered, so that he stands over against us not only as our maker, but in righteous wrath, and we are so blind we do not see it, then what we need is someone to deal with our guilt and shame. That's where Paul is going. And he wants to paint a picture of the sheer ugliness of idolatry. I wish I could give you a whole lecture on ways to get across notions of sin in a postmodern world. I work at that issue in university missions harder than all the other issues put together. It is a very difficult thing to do. There's God. And originally he made human beings in his image. When they woke up in the morning, they thought about him.